I'm Mike Vardy, and this is the Productivityist Podcast. Welcome to the Productivityist Podcast. I am your host, Mike Vardy, and this week on the show, we're going to get back to happy with Mark and Angel Chernoff. With their new book, Getting Back to Happy. I've been friends with Mark and Angel forever. In fact, so much so that during the episode, we get into friend mode where Mark and Angel both start calling me by my last name, which is not, believe me, that was, it's funny because any of you who have a common first name like Mike will know that, you know, when I grew up, there were kids in my class, there was like four Michaels. So all my friends just started calling me by my last name, which was kind of unfortunate with my last name when I was younger, but it's turned around since then. But you could hear later in the episode where they just start saying, hey, Vardy, Vardy, Vardy. And that's just how we speak to one another. I can't use their last name when I talk to them because then they won't know who I'm talking to. But nonetheless, it was great to sit down and chat with them. And we go through their really cool exercise during this episode. So stick around for the whole thing. And let's just get to the whole thing right now. Here's my conversation with Mark and Angel Chernoff on the Productivityist Podcast. Enjoy. I'd like to welcome Mark and Angel Chernoff to the Productivityist Podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Mike.
So the new book is called Getting Back to Happy, Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Reality, and Turn Your Trials into Triumphs. I want to, first off, kind of get a sense of why there's a lot of books on happiness, right? You know, we've seen like Gretchen Rubin's been on the show before. She's talked about the Happiness Project. Sean Acor's got, you know, he talked about the Happiness Advantage. Angel, why did you guys decide to focus on the idea of getting back to happy? And why is that such a pivotal part of the work that you guys do over at your blog and how you were able to kind of get this into a book format? We'll start with you, Angel.
Yes, I think all of us at one point or another have experienced a time where we wanted to be more happy or we were just feeling down. And this book is more than just your typical happiness book. This book talks a lot about the rituals that you need to implement, the actions you need to take to kind of get out of that rut. And what are some things you can actually do rather than read about and get this inspiration from these words, but actually take actions to make progress and get out of that slump.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the whole entire book comes from our own grief and our own issues with adversity. The long story short is that we lost two loved ones back to back to death when we were in our late 20s. And it was a point in time where, you know, that experience piggybacking off of the downturn of the economy and us losing our jobs and struggling financially, we were at a point where emotional struggle, financial struggle, and we just hit rock bottom. And so we were at this point where it was like, you know, we were depressed and we needed to figure out a way to step through that. And like Angel said, the solution for us, which is, you know, that there's a lot that happens there, but the solution for us was to take it one day at a time, to do our research, to read the books by Eckhart Tolle and Byron Katie and so forth, Christian philosophy, Eastern philosophy, and leverage those strategies, not on a one-shot basis, not trying to heal ourselves all at once, but being willing and aware of the fact that the only way we were going to get from where we were to back to a happier, you know, state of mind was to do little things every day. And, you know, some of those little things include are as simple as gratitude journaling and reflecting at the end of the day about what we're grateful for. Some of the more complex things is self-inquiry and really drilling yourself about the actual thoughts that are going on in your head at any given moment that are just defeating you and bringing you down to your knees that are ultimately depressing you. And there's many more, you know, but the book has its baseline, like Angel said, in rituals and the idea that we are what we do every day. We are what we practice. And what we practice is not for just success, but it's for happiness. It's for getting our minds in a state where we can actually interact with the world in a more positive way, regardless of our circumstances.
Yeah. And the way you've organized the book, it kind of like leads off with rituals, then gets into mindfulness. And it's like a progression, which I think, and you could speak to your journey on this, is kind of the way the book is laid out. It kind of indicates this almost like the levels or the evolution of as you get back to happy. Would that be an accurate statement? Either one of you can jump in on this one.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Mike. It really is. You know, you know, for us, it started, we were living in San Diego at the time. And when we kind of hit our rock bottom, you know, the first ritual for us was just getting out of the house, get out of the house, out the door, take about a mile walk down the road to this little area by the bay. It was a bay called Sail Bay. And we'd sit out there and let the sunshine hit our skin. And just, it was our reminder on a daily basis that, hey, like life is going on. Like we're in a dark place, but there is sunshine out here. So like we need to start figuring out how to step forward. And from that, we started, you know, bringing books with us and then challenging ourselves to read various sections to each other and then holding ourselves accountable to the things that we were learning. And that was actually how the blog MarkandAngel.com was born, believe it or not, is it was started just to be a public accountability journal of the things we were holding ourselves accountable to on a daily basis. So it was really like it became the foundation of our rituals. And then, and that's why it's chapter one in the book, because, you know, that is sort of the foundation. It might seem like that's putting the cart ahead of the horse, like, oh, you've got to get your mindset right before you can start taking action. But really, it was the action that drove the passion. And I think that's sometimes something we forget is that, you know, we think we have to wait till we feel better. We think we have to wait to find passion in our lives before we can take the next step. But it really is the action. It's taking those steps that creates the passion and it creates the mindset that allows you to make progress. And so that's why it's step number one. And from there, right, then we dive into mindfulness and other tools that have its foundation in the ritual.
Yeah. And it's one thing to want to get back to happy. It's one thing to read the inspiration, but it's a whole nother thing to start taking those steps and taking action. So we've kind of laid out a blueprint for you to actually follow to start making that progress. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. I've been, we talked before we jumped on the show about when I stayed with you guys in Austin for South by Southwest, when we all spoke at South by Southwest. And one of the things I was fascinated by when I was, let's say in recovery mode, was when, when you two were working, there was almost like a deliberate silence. You each kind of worked on your own things separately, yet you also function incredibly well as a team. And I think that's something that I want to talk a little bit about the writing of the book and building the book as a team. But I also want to talk before that about how important, I mean, I've seen you guys together, seen you guys apart. Like how does that dynamic work where you say, hey, you know what, we're here to support each other, but I also need my time to myself. And I know you've got your son as well. So that you can not just have to lean necessarily on each other all the time, but know that you can, you know, kind of have that happiness with like within the self, as opposed to having it. Cause I think a lot of people do that. A lot of people say, oh, I can't be happy unless this person's happy or so on. So can we dive into that a little bit? Whoever wants to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're very lucky that I am filled up and I get my energy just by being around Mark. So yes, we can sit in a room and, you know, most of the time when we're working together, we're both sitting right next to each other. Like you said, yep. Mike, sitting there doing our own thing. You know, we each have our job and our position within the business. But yeah, we're sitting there doing our thing. And then when we need to, we're communicating and working together. So yeah, we're very fortunate where rather than needing our time apart, we actually fill each other's bucket in and get energy just by merely sitting next to each other and having that between us.
Yeah. It's almost kind of like, I don't know if you've ever done group meditation, but that's sort of what it's like. Mm-hmm. If you can think about that, where you're like in a room with maybe 100 other people and everyone's meditating, you're doing this by yourself, right? And yet the energy, you can feel the energy of the people around you. That's probably the best way to describe it between Angel and I, because you're right. A lot of times we're not communicating. You know, when we have our tasks, we're focused on the tasks, but yet we are in each other's presence. And we do have set breaks where we, you know, obviously we're talking and we're exchanging information. She's proofreading something of mine and vice versa. So yeah, I mean, that's important. But the separation too of realizing that, you know, it's a scheduling thing. You're the master of productivity, we know. And so when it comes to family and treating each other, you know, as business partners, but also as, you know, a married couple, husband and wife, you have to know when to stop, right? You have to know, okay, the end of the day is over. And even though we work for ourselves and we could carry this forward with us, you know, and especially when you're writing the book, right? I mean, you get carried away, you get immersed in this process. And sometimes it's easy to, like, even with having family life, it's easy to let it bleed over, you know, into mm-hmm. 5 p.m., into 6 p.m., instead of cutting ourselves off. So that's, you know, that's something that we've noticed, you know, the ritual of you know, practicing the actual schedule we set for ourselves is important so that we're not sitting around our son or around each other in the evening thinking we should be working and vice versa, right? You have to have that separation of duties. Your work that has made it a more mindful and pleasant experience.
Yeah, I mean, definitely being more present in whatever you're doing right there. So if we're working, we're working, and I'm not thinking about, oh, what activities am I going to schedule for Mac, you know, this week. And when I'm with Mac, I'm not thinking, oh, I should have sent this email. And I definitely struggled with that in the beginning of parenthood. I definitely did for probably a good year, not being able to juggle both. But I think just being present with what I'm doing in that moment and allocating certain times, like, okay, this is work time, this is family time, has helped tremendously.
Right. And when writing the book, right, it's like, you know, when we're writing and we're working, I mean, we are partners in business. And when we are not, we're partners in life. But there is that distinction where we turn that, you know, we flip that on and off based on our schedule.
I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of you know, where people feel that they, where they're at. So let's say they start where they're at. So someone is going to read your book and they start reading your book and the rituals is where they begin. The journaling was one part of it, but because you've dealt with a bunch of people leading up to, you know, in your work, what is one thing, one ritual that you maybe found either through your research or with dealing with people that was rather surprising that kind of triggered that for somebody, what maybe it even was for you, for them to start that journey towards getting back to happy?
Sure. We had mentioned, I think I briefly mentioned self-inquiry, right? Like digging into your own thoughts. And so when you think about journaling and you think about overcoming your adversity and the thoughts that you're having, a lot of people think of journaling as a tool to reflect. And it is. Mm-hmm. And one of the most common forms of journaling for personal development or self-improvement might be something like a gratitude journal, right? At the end of every day, you sit down and you record, you know, let's say 3 to 5 things that you're grateful for during the day. And it's 3 to 5 little things like, I made it home safely from work today. My husband and I are safe and sound. My child is well. It doesn't have to be big things. So that's a very common form of journaling. Now, self-inquiry is maybe the complete opposite of that, and yet that is the one that has had the biggest breakthroughs for us personally and for a lot of our coaching clients and course students. And that involves actually doing the opposite of gratitude journaling. In a sense, it's you are journaling on the very thoughts and experiences throughout your day that have been most stressful. And the way it works is that...
And before you dive into how it works, it's just through our work with, you know, our readers, our community, our course students, we have realized that we're all dealing with so many different situations, but mm-hmm. the core issue mm-hmm. is our thinking of the situations. It's our thoughts. It's how we're thinking about it. So that has been the common thread when we're working with our students and our readers. It's the thinking that each one of us are doing around the particular situation. And you don't even realize it. Like even just talking about it right now, you're like, oh, whatever, it's not my thinking. But when you actually say it out loud, like what you're thinking, you realize that is a story you are telling yourself about that. Like, and the self-inquiry process that Mark is talking about is a way for you to clearly see what you are telling yourself and what is opposites of that. Like, is there anything else I may be missing? Let me look at this situation from a different perspective. So the common thread has definitely been our thinking and our thoughts, each one of us individually.
Right. And, you know, I'm right. It's like, you know, 98% of the time, the problem is not the problem, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is the way we're thinking about the problem. We're all going to have issues. We're all going to have challenges in our lives. And resisting those challenges, believing they should not be the way that they are, is not an exercise that's going to move us forward. But actually focusing on the thoughts that we're having about that, right? Those negative thoughts, those thoughts that are you know, naysaying reality, can help us refocus ourselves and become more mindful of what's really happening and what our next best step forward is. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can give him like a quick example. You know, I could do a quick self-inquiry on you.
Yeah.
Do you want to do that, Mike?
Yeah, let's fire. Yep. And then I'm going to follow up with a question, like a devil's advocate, but like, let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. So Angel, give me a thought You know, and the best way, let me preface it with this, Mike. So we're going to give you a quick example here for you and your listeners. But the way this would really be done, and the reason it's based on journaling, is that what you would do is throughout your day, whenever you feel your anxiety surging, whenever you feel that pressure in the back of your head and in your neck, whenever you realize that some thought is getting the best of you, you would pause and take about 60 seconds. It doesn't have to be any more than that. And you would literally write down that thought. You would write down what's on your mind in that moment that's getting the best of you. And of course, it's not going to be feasible at every moment. You might be in a business meeting or something like that, but most of the time it will be. And so the challenge is, as often as you can throughout the day, whenever you are feeling the anxiety and the high levels of stress that are getting the best of you, pause, take a quick 60 seconds and write down your exact thought. Do like a raw brain dump into a safe place. It could be with a pencil and a pad, could be in an iPhone or an iPad or something like that. Get it out of your head. And the reason you want to do that is because, you know, later on, the second part is to actually review your thoughts, right? So right now we're just recording. We do the recording. And then once a week, we go back and we review thoughts. If I asked you, hey, Mike, you know, how'd you feel last, you know, Monday when you were feeling sick and freaking out about something? You wouldn't remember it. But B, you would kind of downplay its importance. You would think to yourself,
I'm a bit of an arbitrary because I journal, right? So I would go back. I wouldn't remember it offhand, but I'd be able to go back because I'm one of those people that journals, right? So I'd be able to go back and say, how did I feel? And I tend to batch it at the end of the day. So I'll say, like, for example, when I'm sick, and I know we'll definitely get to the exercise I know that last Monday, so not the Monday that, you know, obviously we're talking before I was in California, but the week before that, I was anxious because I wasn't getting the right stuff done. And I could see, because it was my optimization day, and how can you optimize when you're not even feeling good? And number two, I started thinking about things that weren't working with my business because that's all I could do. I couldn't really execute. So there was just a lot of musing and a lot of planning, and that went into that entry. And a lot of good came from that. But if I didn't do that, you're right. If I just knew I was sick on Monday, I'd say I felt like crap. And then regret and shame might show up because it's like, oh, look, thanks, I'm having to revisit this. But sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I'm probably an outlier in this case.
No, I think that's great insight.
Yeah, I think that's great. But I think most people, like you said, you're an outlier. I think most people do not do that. And even if they do journal, and I was guilty of this in the past, was I was just journaling the good things. Mm-hmm. And so this is a way to actually journal, hey, what are the tough things? Instead of avoiding it, bring it to light.
Right, exactly. It's a balance of both. You know, I mean, journaling what we've learned, journaling the things we're grateful for is very important. But that's like one section. We do that, but we can't ignore these thoughts that we're having that are just getting the best of us time and time again.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think you are an outlier, but at the same time. We all have the tendency, whether we're just kind of jotting down and kind of reflecting on our day or not, we do have this tendency, especially if you're doing it in the evenings, like after the fact, and you're not in the heat of the moment. And I think that's the key is the self-inquiry journaling actually happens in real time when your emotions are really high, right? Because when you go back, even in the evening, you think about, you know, the stressful morning you had, you downplay it. You kind of say, it wasn't that big of a deal. You know, I was catastrophizing things, but in the heat of the moment, right, at that moment, it was a huge deal, and it affected the way you were behaving, how effective you were in your work, how effective you were in your relationships, how you were treating yourself and others. So it was incredibly important. It wasn't not a big deal. It actually was a huge deal. Even if you were blowing things out of proportion, it doesn't make a difference. Like, it was affecting everything.
Yeah. Right, right. I think the key there is, like, and it actually leads me to the second question as we were going to get to the exercise here. But when people say they don't have time to do that, well, what if my day is so busy? What if I don't have time? The very reason that they don't think that they have time is the absolute reason why they should do this.
That's exactly right. And that's why it's only 60 seconds long too. So, you know, we're aware that, like, when we set this up with our clients and students, you know, we say, hey, listen, Every single time that you can feasibly do so throughout a day, take 60 seconds and pause when you're feeling the anxiety and the stress levels rise and you're feeling emotional and get that thought down. And when we're saying get the thought down, we're saying write a couple sentences. This isn't a huge journal entry. Just take the time to do it. So don't overwhelm yourself, you know? And if you're in a meeting or doing something, of course, it doesn't make sense to do so. But it's really, it's about, it's small steps. And so 60 seconds, I mean, we can find that time. So that's the first step, is just record throughout the day. Then once a week, you take that journal of thoughts, and for the week, you might have 20 entries, you might have 10 entries, whatever it is. And you open up that thoughts and that journal of thoughts, and you just read through it. And just doing that in itself, as Angel mentioned, kind of brings awareness, right? You're looking at how you were feeling at some of those stressful moments and what was really going on in your head and heart at those moments. And that alone can be quite insightful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the first step. Then you're going to pick the one thought, right? Because we're keeping this simple to start. You pick the one thought that is giving you the most anxiety just by reading it, right? It brings you back to the moment, that time in your week when you were stressed, when anxiety was raging, when you were having, you know, an interaction with somebody that was driving you nuts. Take that thought that gives you the most anxiety just by rereading it, and then you're going to work through a series of questions with it. And so we'll do the exercise. We'll like kind of just do it live rather than just kind of feed the questions to you, just to give you an idea of how it works. So Angel, we'll go back to where we started. Give me a thought during the week, and obviously you haven't written this down, so this isn't a perfect execution of this tool, but a thought that's been bothering you in recent times.
So I have a younger sister that lives about a mile away from me, and the thought that comes to my mind is just the idea that she is the most selfish person in the entire world. That is the thought that comes to mind that just drives me nuts, and I can feel myself boiling up when I think that, and I think it all too often.
Yeah. And I think that's probably a common thought many of us have about certain people in our lives, right? I mean, especially when the anxiety is raging and we're feeling emotional, we're like, oh, like they're such selfish. I mean, they're just a selfish human mm-hmm. being. But let me ask you this. Is that true? And can it be proven? Can it be scientifically proven that your sister is the most selfish person in the entire world?
So when I sit here and think about that, you know, of course I can think of a million examples on what make that thought true, you know? Yes, you know, whenever I talk to her, she always wants to talk about herself. She never really asks me what's going on in my life. It's always about her. I'm always initiating everything. And if I ask her to hang out or try to make plans with her, she leaves her schedule open. She can't fully commit because she wants to see if something else better potentially comes along. So yes, I can think of reasons that thought is true. Now, can it be proven? No, but it's true.
You feel it's true. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Okay. So who are you with that thought in your head? In that situation, interacting with your sister, let's assume you just walk into a room with your sister. No words have been exchanged and you have that thought in your head. And let's assume that you have that thought in your head walking into a room with anyone else as well. Who are you with that thought in your head?
I can definitely say when I'm thinking that thought, I'm agitated, I'm irritated, I'm stressed. I know I'm not the person I want to be. And I feel as though I can't help it. I'm just, I feel the blood boiling. I feel the agitation. Yeah, I'm not who I want to be, but I don't understand why.
And a big part of our thoughts obviously deals with focus. And so I'd be curious to know, like, if you could somehow, and it's much easier said than done, but if you could somehow magically strip that thought out of your head, if you could get rid of that thought and you could walk into that same room with your sister, what else would you see besides that selfish person? Who else would she be?
Wow. That's a powerful one. If I could never think that thought again, and now I have my sister in front of me and I'm looking at her, I see this beautiful, caring person that I love dearly, that is my family member.
And it doesn't mean that your sister is not selfish, of course. At some point, she is, right? Sometimes she is. But it's not an all or nothing situation. This isn't a completely black or white situation. She's a human being who is selfish. Mm-hmm. But is she always selfish? Yeah. And if she's not always selfish, if we can broaden that perspective beyond this one thing we're looking for in this person, you can see more than that, huh?
Yeah. All of a sudden, I realize that I'm going into every interaction with my sister with that thought in my mind, and that is overshadowing all of the positive qualities that she has to offer. And I didn't even realize I was doing that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating thing that when we have a train of thought going on, when something is stressing us out, when anxiety is high, our focus is incredibly mm-hmm. narrow. We're looking at this one thing that's driving us nuts, this one thing about this person or the circumstance that is making us mad, and we ignore everything in the periphery to focus on this one thing. And it doesn't mean that the thing we're focusing on is wrong. It doesn't mean that we're wrong for feeling that way or that this person isn't behaving the way we think they are. But there's more to the story than just that. And when we can broaden the focus beyond that one focal point, we start to see more of the story, yeah. the whole truth.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely aligns with that saying, you know, what you focus on, you see more of. Mm-hmm. And so I was just waiting for my sister to prove me right. You know, I was walking into that situation with a thought in my mind, just looking for it. So I wasn't seeing anything else she had to offer until that moment where she was proving me right that, oh, there it is. She's selfish. She did that. And so, yeah, I didn't even realize I was doing that. So I wasn't even seeing anything good she had to offer.
And the last part of this would be like a flip like of your thought, right? So instead of saying my sister is the most selfish person in the world, my sister is caring. Can you think of examples that make the complete opposite of the thought that's stressing you out true?
Of course. You know, that's easy. My sister gives the best gifts. You know, she's not the person going to the gas station to pick up a gift card on the way to my birthday party. 9 out of 10 times, she's creating something with her hands and she gives the best gifts. And so, yeah. I can definitely think of examples on how she is caring.
And can you think of any other opposites? Maybe instead of your sister is selfish, sometimes you are selfish?
Yeah, I could see how there's truth in that, that maybe I'm the one that's being the selfish one. Maybe I'm the one that wants to just be all about me, me, me.
At least sometimes, yeah. Right? And that's the key, this is an all or nothing thing. It's sometimes. So anyway, Vardy, that's like giving you an example. Like, self-inquiry is a tool that you can leverage to dig into the thoughts that are getting the best of you, to bring perspective to them. And it doesn't mean you're wrong for thinking this. It doesn't mean that this thing that's bothering you isn't happening. But it's realizing that, hey, if that's all I'm focusing on, I am literally bringing myself to my knees and driving myself insane by thinking of it like as the sole focal point of my attention span. And if I can broaden my perspective and broaden my focus, I can see what else is around this so that I can better work with the reality that I have to deal with. And that'll give me the ability to take the right steps around the problem or to address the problem from a different angle. So we can leverage something like this. As Angel said, you know, it applies to our relationships. It applies to our work. It applies to our personal life. It even applies when we're struggling through something like grief and depression. I mean, practices like this, reflecting can be a very beneficial practice if it's done consistently mm-hmm. and if it's done right.
Yeah, the aha moment is really when you're able to realize that what you see is built on what you're thinking and what your thoughts are. And so once we can really accept that and understand what that even means, and it's not something you can just flip a switch and say, oh, I got it. I can change this. It's definitely a process. But realizing that whatever you are seeing, it's an interpretation of your thinking.
So last question I want to throw your way before we wrap up is how do you encourage or motivate people? And I know there's a chapter on this in the book, but to keep this consistent, because often with tactics or strategies like this, or even just because I think that this book is, it's not a book that you're going to just pick up and read and never review again. Like, it's just not like, I mean, because we need encouragement, we need reminders, we need that, you know, that gut check. What are some of the things that you recommend that people can do when that, you know, that bias shows up that says, oh, you know what? This isn't really helping, even though they don't see it up front. It probably is. It's just not helping as apparently. Or they're saying, you know what, I've run out of time. Or they get that, you know, that bias that shows up and says, you can skip it today. And then all of a sudden, today turns into tomorrow, and the next tomorrow, and the next tomorrow. So what are just a couple of tactics that you can share, or that's worked for you even, to keep this consistent so that the benefits last?
Yeah. And we're all guilty of that. You know, we're guilty of that too, saying, oh, we're going to do this. And then we brush it off. And then 2 days turns into a week, turns into a month. And next thing you know, that goes by the wayside. So we're definitely all guilty of that. And I think I'm very similar to you, Vardy, in terms of I am a visual person. So a way to keep me on track that really helps is using the whole don't break the chain, right? That activity, the wall calendar, and marking an X on every time I do the activity. So, you know, with the self-inquiry practice and the other rituals that we suggest in the Getting Back to Happy book is every time you do it, marking an X through that day and being consistent. So every day you want to put that X through that day. And then when you get a week in and you're like, oh man, I don't have time to do this, or I don't feel like doing this, you're going to look at that calendar and you're going to be like, oh, but I don't want to break the chain. So I'm going to fit it in. I'm going to squeeze it in. So it sounds so simple, but it works. So just having that wall calendar of where you've got those X's, and on those days where I feel like, oh my gosh, I don't have time, and I look at that and I'm like, well, there's no way I'm going to break this chain of 30 days straight. You know, I want to be consistent. And so that keeps me motivated.
Yeah, I think visual reminders are incredibly important. I mean, we have students and clients who have like their bank statements taped to computers to remind them of the debt they want to pay off. I mean, we have one woman who keeps it sounds almost negative, but it has helped her immensely, keeping a picture of herself when she was like 90 pounds heavier on her refrigerator as a reminder of who she doesn't want to be and what she's working for and the progress she's made when she looks in the mirror versus that picture. So visual reminders, I mean, don't break the chain. I agree. Incredibly powerful. One of the other ones too, which is a classic, but Angel and I do it a little bit differently and actually suggest it differently in the book, is accountability. And having an accountability partner. And we do it a little bit different. So I'll give you a quick example of ours is you would have an accountability partner. So let's say Angel and I are accountability partners, and we are, so that works. And I at the beginning of every month, I would write down a list of things, usually 10 things, but it can be as low as 5, but things that I want to hold myself accountable to. So we usually have a list of 10. And one of those might be the self-inquiry process. One of those might be evening journaling or morning journaling. One of those for me, for sure, is always spending at least 1 hour of uninterrupted, focused, present time with my son, and so forth. And so I would write this list of things to myself. These are the things that I want to hold myself accountable to throughout the month. Angel would write her own list to herself, and then we would switch papers. And every single day, I will, if Angel's in front of me, I will just ask her the questions at the end of the day. If she's not with me and we're on, you know, someplace different on business or whatever, I will call her on the phone. But without fail, we will call each other and we will get in touch and we will read each other our questions, right? And so she's reading me my questions and I'm reading her questions. So it doesn't feel like she's badgering me, because these are the questions I want to ask myself. Right. And that's important, I think, with accountability. A lot of times we feel like someone's like pressuring us. We're like, oh, stay away from me. Don't check up on me. But this is a way for you to, you're actually having another human being ask you your own questions. And then, you know, I just simply put a one. That's what we do, is we put a one next to each one we can say yes to. And hopefully the goal is to get that perfect 10, but we're not always perfect. So it can help, it helps hold us accountable to the things we're doing, and also gives us an idea about where we're slacking off. If there's something that I never am putting a one next to after like a couple weeks, maybe that's not really a priority to me and maybe I need to rethink it. So it can help you kind of take a look at what your priorities are as well.
Yeah. And also just if you're not marking it, if you're not able to say yes, just remove it and let there be no guilt. Like, remove it. It's not a priority. It's okay. Let that weight be gone and be okay with it, seeing as you haven't done it in the last, you know, week or so.
Right. And it's the you know, because the idea too is that when someone is checking up on you and actually physically like making the call or standing in front of you with your own list, if it really matters to you, if it really is a priority, right? Spending an hour with my son is a big priority to me. And if I miss a one day, fine, right? But if I'm consistently missing it, then usually that's enough to slap me right back into place.
Right.
If I can somehow push through months of not doing it, then like Angel said, it's probably not a priority to begin with. So it's time to reevaluate things.
This has been great. The new book, Getting Back to Happy, Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Reality, and Turn Your Trials into Triumphs, is now available. It's like just out. So where can people go to learn more about you guys as well as get the book?
Sure. At markandangel.com, and that's M-A-R-C with a C. And, you know, you can find the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. We really appreciate your time, Vardy. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
So you are now that much closer to happy after listening to this episode. I encourage you to go pick out their new book. Get it for wherever fine books are sold. Getting Back to Happy, of course, the links will be in the show notes and you can learn about it there. Big thanks to them for taking the time to join me today. It's always really interesting when you have two people on the show and you're not seeing each other. So you could see that because we've had the opportunity to hang out many times, we can kind of get a sense of who's going to speak when. No magic editing tricks there per se. I didn't put too much on my producer, John Polster, for this one. But, again, just a great conversation. And Mark and Angel are just truly fantastic people. And I'm so happy to have been able to have them on the show and bring them to you today. Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thanks for tuning in. I'd like to thank John Polster for producing the show, as he does every single week. I'd like to thank my team for putting together the show notes and the graphics and all the other things that go into making this show work. And I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, I am your host, Mike Vardy, reminding you to stop guessing and start going.